Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 566, titled Middle East Matrix, It Ain't Necessarily So, subtitled He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, Part 3. This is being recorded on August 27th of the year 2006. Before I launch into the main subject material, lots of websites, www.spitfirelist.com and many linked websites with a vast amount of information on them. Those of you who have who only listen to the broadcasts are missing the better part of the For the Record experience, and I can't encourage you strongly enough to use not only the long article-length descriptions of each program, but a small anti-fascist library of long out-of-print books, vast amounts of audio information on the WFMU websites, and the huge, huge amount of information available online that supplements these broadcasts. Please use them. Now, in this program, we're going to continue with a subject that is necessary, but that I'm approaching with a fair amount of, frankly, emotional reluctance. As I mentioned in For the Record 565, there is no, well, with the exception of the O.J. Simpson case, there is no subject that I've ever covered where people are more virulent, more polarized, more frankly vicious than they are vis-a-vis the whole Israeli-Palestinian thing, or really the Israelis and the Arabs. And just as was the case with the O.J. case, to a large extent, people simply have not been given the right information. There's an awful lot going on in the world, and I'm going to certainly continue with this sequence of programs for a few weeks, but there's an awful lot of other things. There are an awful lot of other things going on. I do think, however, that it's important to cover this not only because it's an important subject, but in many ways the fierce anti-Semitism that is manifesting itself, often under the cover of, quote, anti-Zionism, unquote, or sympathy for the, quote, Palestinians, unquote, it's reaching some pretty serious levels, and in one sense it surprises me, and in one sense it doesn't. It surprises me because I still find myself under the illusion that this is an enlightened society, and that humanity itself is, at least relative to what it was in the past, somewhat enlightened. That's really not the case. And also, at the same time, it doesn't surprise me because this country and this world are going Nazi. I mean, absolutely, totally, King Hell Bleep and Nazi with a capital N. And at some point, the dogmatic, virulent anti-Semitism that is characteristic of Nazism must of necessity manifest itself. And it is happening. This program might be titled Walking the Snake in Lebanon, a reference to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that I've talked about so often. We'll get back into that at some point in times, time permitting. However, I think that things on the world stage are approaching the point of no return, and I fear, frankly, catastrophic events in the not-too-distant future. I don't mean necessarily between now and the 2006 election, or even necessarily the 2008 election, but I think we are heading to the last roundup. And I think that a manipulation of the situation in the Middle East is going to fit in to, frankly, the realization of an apocalyptic scenario that is held in common to a certain extent, at least, by a number of religions. Many members of the listening audience may be familiar with the fundamentalist Christian view that events in the Middle East are adhering to prophecy and that we are approaching the end times. John Loftus, a couple of weeks ago, properly corrected me. I did not mean to imply necessarily that fundamentalist Christians want to wipe out Jews. On the opposite side of the aisle, so to speak, President Ahmadinejad of Iran does. He is a Shia fundamentalist of a stripe that believes in an apocalyptic scenario of the return of the hidden imam, the Mahdi. And he does want to wipe out the Jews. And with two groups of people seeing things in apocalyptic terms and with weapons of mass destruction being a present reality in the world, I am fearful, extremely fearful for the future. And at some point in the not-too-distant future, and people, by the way, people will think that I'm completely whacked when I say what I'm about to say. But at some point, I'm going to revisit the whole subject of, quote, UFOs, unquote. Make a long story short, UFOs are real. They don't come from outer space. You've seen a Frisbee. Well, you think the government or high-tech corporations can't make Frisbees? Well, they can. I mentioned this. The very first thing that interested me in UFOs was a statement back in the early 80s from Billy Graham, who's a political animal. He said, quote, UFOs are real. They're angels sent by Jesus, unquote. And UFOs weren't on my radar screen, no pun intended. I saw that. I said, whoa, what is going on here? And I think at some point, UFOs and apocalyptic scenarios are going to bring about a different sort of end times. Times won't end, but a lot of people may wish they'd ended when they see what it's all coming down to. A preview of this, by the way, there are two lectures available for download for free on the Spitfire website on both MP3 and real audio. One is the political implications of the UFO phenomenon and the ET myth. And the other is the future, technology, theocracy, and the thousand-year Reich. And that'll give you an idea of where I'm going with this. I'm afraid that we are heading to the last roundup and that necessarily some things are going to have to be laid out. And one of those things, at some point, I think maybe next week, maybe the week after, I'll do a thumbnail synopsis of the history of the Israeli-Arab conflict. I do not, as I mentioned last week, I do not archive material on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. I have limited resources. I only have so much storage space. Plus, as I said, it is as emotionally charged as the OJ situation, and people have been as fundamentally misinformed about the essential realities as they have been about the OJ case. People came to believe that O.J. Simpson was a horrible murderer who killed his wife and then got off because a bunch of irresponsible black people basically were on the jury in the criminal case. In fact, the media did not give them an accurate portrayal of what was actually taking place, and that's also the case vis-a-vis not only the entire Arab-Israeli conflict, but in particular the latest flare-up in Lebanon. In our discussion with John Loftus a couple of weeks ago in For the Record 564, John mentioned that it has been said that politics is biography. In his opinion, politics is economics, and I agree with that completely. Part of the reason why the view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been so distorted is because of economics. For one thing, the Arabs have oil and the Israelis don't. Oil is arguably the greatest source of wealth and power in the modern industrial world, not only because of oil itself, but also because of the tremendous amount of money that petroleum-producing countries are able to reinvest in the Western economies. And beyond that, the Islamist agenda, as exemplified by the Muslim Brotherhood, is favored by the multinational corporations as a vehicle for privatization and globalization, particularly in the third world. 2 weeks ago, again in our conversation with John Loftus, John mentioned that the multinational corporations do not have America's best interest in mind. That's really quite not only an accurate statement, but a profound statement, particularly coming from someone with the mainstream background that John Loftus has. And that is the case. We're going to go into that in weeks to come. For the Record programs, numbers 560 and 561, Economics 911, Parts 1 and 2, go into that. But in part, economics has a lot to do with it. The Arabs have oil, the Israelis don't. The Arabs have the resulting investment capital, the Israelis don't. Plus, the whole thing is spiced with anti-Semitism. And that is definitely one of the factors in this whole thing. We're about to deal with the distortion of the news about the recent war in Lebanon. Economics is part of it, not only the fact that the Arabs have oil and the Israelis don't, anti-Semitism is part of it, but also the reinvested capital by the capital that has been reinvested by the petroleum-producing countries in the Western economies, the media in particular. In Economics 911 Part 2, I mentioned, for example, the profound control that Arab oil-producing countries have, or the profound influence, I should say, in American media. Largest media corporation in the world is AOL, Time Warner. It is controlled by a minority consortium of Saudi princes headed up by Prince Al-Waleed. That's the largest media company in the world. When you hear CNN, you're listening to a Saudi media outlet for all intents and purposes. Prince Al-Waleed is also the second largest investor in Fox News, or its News Corp parent corporation. The third largest media corporation in the world is ABC, Disney. Prince Al-Waleed is heavily invested with Disney. Disney, Walt Disney, that is, was a member of the was a frequent attendee at American Nazi Party meetings prior to World War II. He was a raving anti-Semite. It is merged with ABC. ABC was bought out by Cap Cities, whose top dog, and I mean that literally, was William Casey, who brought over many of these SS and Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II to join with not only the U.S. intelligence apparatus, but the Republican Party as part of the Crusade for Freedom. William Casey's personal pilot was a guy named Heinrich Rupp, who was an ME-262 pilot for the Luftwaffe in World War II. The number four corporation, that's the number three media corporation, ABC Disney. Number four is Bertelsmann, the publisher for the SS in World War II. People say, well, that's a long time ago, but Dirk Bovendam, the official house historian for Bertelsmann, the fourth largest media corporation in the world, basically published a series of books, the most recent in 1998, blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control over the American news media, which is a pretty damned interesting interpretation of World War II for the company that dominates English language publishing. So economics is part of it, the resulting media control that stems from that is part of it, and anti-Semitism is part of it, too. We're going to be taking a look now at an article from the National Post, that's a mainstream Canadian newspaper, talking about the bias in the news media. One of the points to note here is that the BBC hasn't been in many ways leading the charge. BBC has some very good coverage of some things, but the BBC, unfortunately, showing in many ways the worst side of the British imperial character vis-a-vis events in the Middle East, perhaps evidencing bitterness over the fact that one of the things that helped the sun to set on the British Empire was when the Jews kicked the British out of that particular part of their Middle Eastern empire. Also, the BBC has a very, very strong connection to British intelligence, specifically MI6, and it works hand in glove with MI6. Also, many major British correspondents work hand in glove with British intelligence. We should note in that context that Britain is envisioning itself as one of the centers for Islamic finance in the West because of the tremendous amounts of money that are flowing into Middle Eastern coffers because of the increase in oil prices. A lot of people want to get in on the reinvested money that's coming back out, and the British are in their pitching, so to speak. The United Kingdom sees itself as the potential center for Islamic finance in the Western world, perhaps making the British what one could call perhaps petro-dhimmis. Dhimmitude is sort of a subservient second-class citizenship that reactionary Muslims see as appropriate for all Jews and Christians, provided they don't actively oppose Islam. It's a complicated concept. It's spelled D-H-I-M-M-I, but it basically renders Christians and Jews in this particular Islamic interpretation as second-class citizens. And because oil wealth has a lot to do with it, we could perhaps term the British and also some of the European attitude as petro-dhimmi. In any event, the National Post of Wednesday, August 2nd of 2006, the National Post, a mainstream Canadian paper, has the following article by Tom Gross. It's called The Media War Against Israel, subtitled, The Jewish State is Fighting Not One Enemy But Two, Hezbollah and Those Who Peddle Its Propaganda. The article reads, large sections of the international media are not only misreporting the current conflict in Lebanon, they are actively fanning the flames. The BBC World Service has a strong claim to be the number one villain. It has come to sound like a virtual propaganda tool for Hezbollah. As it attempts to prove that Israel is guilty of committing war crimes, unquote, and crimes against humanity, unquote, it has introduced a new charge, one which I have heard several times on air in recent days. The newscaster reads out carefully selected audience comments, unquote. Among these are invariably contained some version of the claim that, quote, Israel's attack on Lebanon, unquote, will serve as a, quote, recruitment, unquote, drive for Al-Qaeda. But if anything is going to win new recruits for Osama bin Laden and his like, it will not be Israel's defensive actions, which are far less damaging than Western TV stations would have us believe, but the inflammatory and one-sided way in which they are being reported by those very same news organizations. While the slanted comments and interviews are bad enough, the degree of pictorial distortion is even worse. From the way many TV stations worldwide are portraying it, you would think that Beirut has begun to resemble Dresden and Hamburg in the aftermath of Second World War air raids. International television channels have used the same footage of Beirut over and over, showing the destruction of a few individual buildings in a manner which suggests half the city has been razed. A careful look at aerial satellite photos of the areas targeted by Israel and Beirut shows that certain specific buildings housing Hezbollah command centers in the city's southern suburbs have been singled out. Most of the rest of Beirut, apart from strategic sites such as airport runways used to ferry Hezbollah weapons in and out of Lebanon, has been left pretty much untouched. From the distorted imagery, selective witness accounts, and almost round-the-clock emphasis on casualties, you would be forgiven for thinking that the level of death and destruction in Lebanon is on a par with that in Darfur, where Arab militias are slaughtering hundreds of thousands of non-Arabs, or with the 2004 tsunami that killed 500,000 in Southeast Asia. In fact, Israel has taken great care to avoid killing civilians, even though this has proven extremely difficult and often tragically impossible, since members of Hezbollah, the self-styled Party of God, unquote, have deliberately ensconced themselves in civilian homes. Nevertheless, the civilian death toll has been mercifully low compared to other international conflicts in recent years. Last week, a senior journalist let slip how the news media allows its Mideast coverage to be distorted. CNN senior international correspondent, unquote, Nick Robertson, bear in mind, CNN is always controlled by the Saudis, admitted that his anti-Israel report from Beirut on July 11th about civilian casualties in Lebanon was managed from start to finish by Hezbollah. In particular, he revealed that his story was heavily influenced by the group's, quote, press officer, unquote, and that Hezbollah have, quote, very, very sophisticated and slick media operations, unquote. When pressed a few days later about his reporting on the CNN program Reliable Sources, Robertson acknowledged that Hezbollah militants had instructed the CNN camera team where and what to film. Hezbollah, quote, had control of the situation, unquote, Robertson said, again quoting, "They designated the places that we went to, and we certainly didn't have time to go into the houses or lift up the rubble to see what was underneath," unquote. Robertson added that Hezbollah has, quote, very, very good control over its areas in the south of Beirut. They deny journalists access to those areas. You don't get in there without their permission. We didn't have enough time to see if perhaps there was somebody there who was, you know, a taxi driver by day and a Hezbollah fighter by night, unquote. Yet Reliable Sources, presented by Washington Post writer Howard Kurtz, is broadcast only on the American version of CNN. So CNN international viewers around the world will not have had the opportunity to learn that the pictures they saw from Beirut were carefully selected for them by Hezbollah. Another journalist let the cat out of the bag last week. Writing on his blog while reporting from southern Lebanon, Time magazine contributor Christopher Albritton casually mentioned in the middle of a posting, quote, "To the south, along the curve of the coast, Hezbollah is launching Katyushas, but I'm loath to say too much about them. The Party of God has a copy of every journalist's passport, and they've already hassled a number of us and threatened one," unquote. Robertson is not the only foreign journalist to have misled viewers with selected footage from Beirut. NBC's Richard Engel, CBS's Elizabeth Palmer, and a host of other European and other networks were also taken around the damaged areas by Hezbollah minders. Palmer commented on her report that Hezbollah is also determined that outsiders will only see what it wants them to see, unquote. Palmer's honesty is helpful, but it doesn't prevent the damage being done by organizations such as the BBC, whose bias is obvious to those who know the facts. First, the BBC gave the impression that Israel had flattened the greater part of Beirut. Then, to follow up its lopsided coverage, its website helpfully carried full details of the assembly points for an anti-Israel march due to take place in London, but did not give any details about a rally in support of Israel also held in London a short time later. Indeed, the BBC's coverage of the present war has been so extraordinary that even staunch BBC supporters in London seem rather embarrassed, in conversation, not on the air, unfortunately. If the BBC were just a British problem, that would be one thing, but it isn't. Thanks to British taxpayers, it is the world's biggest and most lavishly funded news organization. No other station broadcasts so extensively in dozens of languages on TV and radio and online. And Dave would add parenthetically, it also has a very close relationship with MI6, British Foreign Intelligence. Continuing, the BBC's radio service alone attracts over 163 million listeners. It pours forth its worldview in almost every language of the Middle East, Pashto, Persian, Arabic, and Turkish. Needless to say, it declines to broadcast in Hebrew, even though it does broadcast in the languages of other small nations, Macedonian and Albanian, Azeri and Uzbek, Kinyarwanda and Kyrgyz, and so on. It is not just that the supposed crimes of Israel are completely overplayed, but the fact that this is a two-sided war, started, of course, by Hezbollah, is all but obscured. As a result, in spite of hundreds of hours of broadcast by dozens of BBC reporters and studio anchors, you wouldn't really know that hundreds of thousands of Israelis have been living in bomb shelters for weeks now, tired, afraid, but resilient, that a grandmother and her 7-year-old grandson were killed by a Katyusha rocket during a Friday night Sabbath dinner, that several other Israeli children have died. You wouldn't really have any understanding of what it is like to have over 2,000 Iranian and Syrian rockets rain down indiscriminately on towns, villages, and farms across one-third of your country aimed specifically at killing civilians. You wouldn't really appreciate that Hezbollah, far from being some ragtag militia, is in effect a division of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards with relatively advanced weapons, unmanned aerial vehicles that have flown over northern Israel, extended-range artillery rockets, anti-ship cruise missiles, and so forth, and that it has a global terror reach, having already killed 114 people in Argentina during the 1990s. Or, as Dave would point out, but as Mr. Gross has not pointed out, it also basically is an Islamic fascist organization that uses the Nazi salute. Continuing, the BBC and other media have carried report after report on the damaged Lebanese tourist industry, but none on its damaged Israeli counterpart, even though at least one hotel in Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee was hit by a Hezbollah rocket. There are reports of Lebanese children who don't know where they will be going to school, but none on Israeli children. Many have grown accustomed to left-wing papers such as Britain's Guardian allowing their Mideast coverage to spill over into something akin to anti-Semitism. For example, last month, a cartoon by The Guardian's Martin Rosen depicted Stars of David being used as knuckle dusters on a bloody fist. Now, the conservative-leaning Daily Telegraph, Britain's best-selling quality daily, and previously one of the only papers in Europe to give Israel a fair hearing, has gotten in on the act. The cartoon at the top of the Telegraph comment page last Saturday showed two identical scenes of devastation, exactly the same in every detail. One was labeled Warsaw 1943, the other Tyre 2006. The suggestion, of course, is that modern Israel is no different from Nazi Germany. A politician had already given the cue for this horrendous libel. Conservative MP Sir Peter Tapsell told the House of Commons that British Prime Minister Tony Blair was colluding, unquote, with U.S. President George W. Bush in giving Israel the okay to wage a war crime, quote, gravely reminiscent of the Nazi atrocity on the Jewish quarter of Warsaw, unquote. Of course, there was no Jewish quarter, unquote, of Warsaw. In case anyone needs reminding, Sir Peter obviously does, the ghetto in the Polish capital established in October of 1940 constituted less than 3 square miles. Over 400,000 Jews were then crammed into it, about 30% of the population of Warsaw. 254,000 were sent to Treblinka, where they were exterminated. Most of the rest were murdered in other ways. The ghetto was completely cleared of Jews by the end of May 1943. The picture isn't entirely bleak. Some British and European politicians on both the left and right have been supportive of Israel. So have some magazines such as Britain's Spectator. So have a number of individual newspaper commentators. But meanwhile, anti-Semitic coverage and cartoons are spreading across the globe. Norway's third-largest newspaper, the Oslo Daily Dagbladet, ran a cartoon comparing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to the infamous Nazi commander SS Major Amon Goeth, who indiscriminately murdered Jews by firing at them from his balcony, as depicted by Ralph Fiennes in Steven Spielberg's film Schindler's List. A month earlier, Dagbladet published an article, The Third Tower, which questioned whether Muslims were really responsible for the September 11th attacks. Antonio Neri Lecion of Mexico's El Economista drew what appeared to be a Nazi soldier with Stars of David on his uniform. The soldier, unquote, was surrounded by eyes that he had apparently gouged out. A cartoon in the South African Sunday Times depicted Ehud Olmert with a butcher's knife covered in blood. In the leading Australian daily The Age, a cartoon showed a wine glass full of blood being drunk in a scene reminiscent of a medieval blood libel. In New Zealand, veteran cartoonist Tom Stott came up with a drawing which equated Israel with Al-Qaeda. At least one leading European politician has also vented his prejudice through visual symbolism. Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero wore an Arab scarf during an event at which he condemned Israel, but not Hezbollah, who he presumably thinks should not be stopped from killing Israelis. It's entirely predictable that all this violent media distortion should lead to Jews being attacked and even murdered, as happened at a Seattle Jewish center last week. When live Jews can't be found, dead ones are targeted. In Belgium last week, the urn that contained ashes from Auschwitz was desecrated at the Brussels Memorial to the 25,411 Belgian Jews deported to Nazi death camps. It was smashed and excrement smeared over it. The silence from Belgian leaders following this desecration was deafening. Other Jews continue to be killed in Israel itself without being mentioned in the media abroad. Last Thursday, for example, 60-year-old Dr. Daniel Yaakovi was murdered by the Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, the terrorist group within Fatah that Yasser Arafat set up 5 years ago using European Union aid money. But this is far from being an exclusively Jewish issue. Some international journalists seem to find it amusing or exciting to bait the Jews. They don't understand yet that Hezbollah is part of a worldwide, radical Islamist movement that has plans, and not pleasant ones, for all those Muslim, Christian, Hindu, and Jew, and I would add, even Chinese, long known as the Jews of Asia, who don't abide by its wishes. We're going to be talking more about the subject of the distorted coverage and even outright fabrication, such as the alleged targeting of ambulances by the Israeli Air Force and the Khanna non-massacre, as John Loftus put it. That, however, in side two of the broadcast. www.spitfirelist.com. A vast amount of information on that website. And also, please take advantage of other linked websites, www.wfmu.org. There's a mini library of about a dozen or so old, long out of print, anti-fascist books available for download for free. Each For the Record show is turned into an article-length description. Descriptions of other lectures, archive shows, websites with documentation about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. There's a search function on the Spitfire website. All kinds of audio files available for download from the Spitfire website as well. Plus, there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way. Or if you don't like what's going on, I should say, there's no better way to support what I'm doing than to support what I'm doing. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 566, Middle East Matrix, Part 2, It Ain't Necessarily So. Subtitled, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages. This is being recorded on August 27th, 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.